Good morning, everyone. Oddly, we don't have a gavel today, so this is the ceremonial water bottle that is going to serve as a gavel for a few minutes at least. So I would like to call to order this meeting of the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law, and a quorum is present. And today is Tuesday, February 24th. So first order of business, I think, is to read the safety notice, which we're being asked to read now for each committee hearing. And so in order to ensure that everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we're going to ask for everyone's cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility. For safety, security, and comfort, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted. This is a longstanding rule. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. No applause or other audible demonstrations. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you need an accommodation, please speak to the sergeant staff wearing gold ties. State troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. As always, testimony will be given specific time limits, which we would ask you to observe. And if you have an entrance ticket, please retain it. You might need it for reentry if you leave the hearing room. So we ask you to comply with these guidelines. If folks don't comply, we will have to ask them to leave and remove them from the room. So with that, may I have a motion, Representative Mahmoud, to approve the minutes
for April 10th? Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
All right, thank you. So the minutes have been moved for Thursday. Oh, wait a minute now. That's the wrong minutes. What are the minutes we're moving here? I want to make sure we got the right ones. This one, right? The 19th. This is a different thing on here. Okay. So the minutes for February 19th have been moved. All in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. See, I got it. Now I got a gavel. So we are official. Okay. So the first thing today is we're going to start with a presentation by the ACLU of Minnesota. Today we're going to be talking a lot about civil rights in Minnesota, and so we're going to start with this presentation, and whoever wants to go first, if you would please introduce yourself, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Julia Decker. I am the Policy Director for the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, or ILCM. ILCM is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that provides free immigration legal services to low-income immigrants and refugees across the state of Minnesota and also in North Dakota. I'd like to provide some opening context for the very sobering information that my colleagues from the ACLU of Minnesota are going to provide about what we have seen in Minnesota since December.
And Ms. Decker, let me just have you pause for a second. Can everyone hear? It seems very soft to me.
Yes.
I wonder if we can turn the volume up.
I am as close to the mic.
That
is much
better.
Okay.
If you can do that, yes.
This is better. Okay.
Please proceed.
So what we have experienced in Minnesota since the start of Operation Metro Surge has occurred in the context of ongoing major immigration law and policy shifts at the federal level that are requiring monthly, weekly, and sometimes even daily updates to the ways we advise and educate our clients and the community. Immigrants and refugees, including those with lawful status and those applying for lawful status, have been subject to over a year of increasingly restrictive policies and procedures from the federal government. What we've experienced here in Minnesota has also occurred in a moment of extremely low transparency. The immigration system, particularly the enforcement and removal deportation system, is already extremely opaque and has become even more so under the current administration. You're going to hear from my colleagues about reports of potential constitutional violations and federal court orders being ignored by the federal government. I want to emphasize that we often receive additional reports of these types of violations occurring when we speak with impacted people and community members. However, the speed at which current enforcement operations are occurring, the fear of speaking out, and the need to prioritize identifying, locating, and contacting people who have been detained often makes following up and verifying reports extremely difficult. Moreover, the relative timelines of federal litigation and immigration proceedings creates a situation where even if there are blatant, egregious violations of a person's civil rights that could be remedied in federal court, an impacted person could very well be deported long before the civil rights case is ever resolved. For this committee, I want to make sure I highlight a couple key points. First and foremost, it's important to understand that immigration courts are not part of the federal judiciary, but are instead housed within the Department of Justice, which is an executive agency, in what's called the Executive Office for Immigration Review. Second, while people in immigration court proceedings have a right to an attorney is not provided to them by the government as it would be in a criminal court proceeding if they cannot afford to pay for one. So if they are not able to afford an attorney, it is very likely they will have to proceed pro se, despite the often life and death implications of deportation proceedings. In the operation in Minnesota, we have often seen people sent to detention facilities in other states, sometimes within hours. Family, friends, and even lawyers who are on record of representing these people can't find them because the government's own online locator isn't being updated. People have been and are effectively disappearing. We raise these issues in the context of the immigration system and the most recent operation that is purportedly coming to an end in Minnesota. For our part at ILCM, we want to emphasize the extreme harm that has been and continues to be inflicted on Minnesota's immigrant and refugee communities. At the same time, and as you will hear, we want to note that these are also attacks on constitutional underpinnings, on bedrock constitutional principles. And as such, they have implications for all Minnesotans, citizen and non-citizen alike. We also want to emphasize that while this has been and continues to be an extremely critical time for our immigrant and refugee communities, this kind of disregard for humanity, this kind of dehumanization, people disappearing from the locator for hours and days at a time, shackles on people in detention centers and on planes, children in detention centers. For many immigration lawyers, this is not new. We have been confronting this for years and even decades across multiple administrations. This crisis did not happen overnight. It could not happen overnight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say, I apologize. The Immigrant Law Center is different than the ACLU, and I didn't mention that at the outset, so thank you so much for being here. Please proceed.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairs Liebling, Scott, members of the committee. My name is John Beeler, and I'm the policy counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. I have with me today Alicia Grancy, staff attorney for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on the state of constitutional rights. The plan for our presentation today is to walk through how we got here, what we and other legal service providers have seen on the ground, what the federal government has told us here and around the country, how the federal judiciary has reacted to the agencies of the executive branch, and then how these impacts are being felt in other legal areas. By way of background on how we arrived here in these circumstances, in December 2025, the Department of Homeland Security announced the beginning of Operation Metro Surge, which included the deployment of 3,000 agents, including 2,000 from Immigration and Customs Enforcement and 1,000 from Customs and Border Protection, which ICE Director Todd Lyons called the largest immigration operation ever. And this was, lest we forget, ostensibly a supplemental fraud investigation. What we have witnessed in the last 3 months is one of the largest deprivations of constitutional protections in the history of our state. Largest here includes the number of constitutional protections violated and the sheer volume of violations by federal officers. These actions have resulted in the deaths of multiple Minnesotans, including the shooting deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, and the custodial death of Victor Manuel Diaz. The ACLU of Minnesota has received over 700 reports of constitutional violations, and the Attorney General has received over 1,000. This is obviously only a small sliver of actual incidents because it does not include those where individuals do not know about our reporting form, or where they were afraid of retaliation for making contact, or due to the nature of their detention, there was nobody left to file a report. Habeas petitions since December are over 1,000, when there were only 73 in the 12 preceding months. According to Reuters, across the country, over 400 different federal judges have found at least 4,421 cases where the government was illegally holding someone. The ACLU of Minnesota has two cases in federal court stemming from the government's actions these past months. Pincher v. Noem is a case involving violations of the First Amendment rights of individuals to document and protest ICE activity and their Fourth Amendment's rights to be free from unreasonable seizures and excessive force. On January 26, Judge Menendez of the U.S. District Court of Minnesota entered a preliminary injunction holding that the plaintiffs were likely to succeed on the merits of their claims. That injunction has been stayed by the Eighth Circuit. In Hussein v. Noem, we are seeking a preliminary injunction prohibiting federal agents from their unconstitutional practices of making unlawful warrantless arrests and of stopping, questioning, and detaining Minnesotans on the basis of their race and ethnicity. Our motion for preliminary injunction, which was argued last week and is still pending before the court. Additional cases have been filed by the state of Minnesota and the cities of Minnesota and St. Paul alleging 10th Amendment violations by Fridley Public School District for violations of the Administrative Procedure Act, and the Advocates for Human Rights alleging First, Fourth, and Sixth Amendment violations. The advocates recently won a victory over access to counsel and detainee transfer, with the court ordering that the government ensure every non-citizen is taken into custody within 1 hour is provided a simple list of materials. Their A number, their alien registration number, a copy of the order, telephone numbers for free legal service providers, written and oral translations in English, Spanish, Hmong, Somali, and French, and free, private, unmonitored access to the telephone.
Mr. Wheeler, could you pull the mic a little bit closer, please? Thank you.
Yes, Chair. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. They also required that no transfers were made out of Minnesota within 72 hours, and that when detainees were set for a transfer, they were informed of the destination and provided time to call and inform their family and attorneys of that planned transfer. When we think of constitutional violations, we generally think of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. We have violations of or threats to violate six of those amendments in the last 3 months. Threatening to violate constitutional rights is in itself a violation of those rights because of the chilling effect it has on people's ability to exercise and utilize those rights. The First Amendment explicitly protects several freedoms, including free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly. Courts have also long read into the First Amendment a right of freedom of association. The First Amendment right to free speech includes the right to peacefully document law enforcement officers engaged in their official duties. As the court in Tincher noted, that is true of every circuit court to have considered the question. And yet, when our client Susan Tincher was observing ICE conduct and asking if agents were with ICE in Minneapolis, she was pulled to the ground, handcuffed, removed to the federal Whipple building, where agents removed her clothes and cut off her wedding ring. She was eventually released after 5 hours in custody. The Tincher case alone contains over 115 declarations, sworn statements of Minnesotans exercising their First Amendment rights who are subjected to federal harassment, violence, and detention. Federal agents have violated the rights of the press. Last month, ICE agents threatened to break the window and detain two Italian journalists who were recording their activity. Last month, the DOJ sought an arrest warrant for journalist Don Lemon for covering a protest, which was denied by the federal magistrate judge. Earlier this week, last month, the freedom of association was threatened when FBI Director Kash Patel threatened an investigation into text groups that Minnesotans were using to notify neighbors of ICE activities, to coordinate rent and food relief, and to alert their school and daycare workers of the presence of federal agents. After the killing of, on the Second Amendment, after the killing of Alex Preddy, FBI Director Patel said that Americans, quote, cannot bring a firearm to any sort of protest you want. Similarly, President Trump said, quote, you can't have guns. You can't walk in with guns in response. All Americans, including gun owners, have First Amendment rights. While gun ownership is a separate constitutional right and gun use itself is considered conduct outside of First Amendment protection, gun owners do have equally strong core First Amendment rights to speech and protest. The government cannot treat lawfully armed speakers more harshly simply because of their views or the fact that they are lawfully carrying firearms. On the Fourth Amendment, which bars the government from unreasonable search and seizure of an individual or their private property. In our litigation, Hussein v. Noem, we identified numerous stops made by federal agents solely on racial and ethnic appearance of those detained. Our clients, like Mr. Hussein, who were physically restrained and dragged into a squad car. Declarants, like Mr. Saki, who needed hospitalization. And AA, who was handcuffed and forced into a squad car. Rarely, if ever, do federal agents meet the requirements necessary for these stops. Probable cause to believe both that a person is removable and that they are a flight risk. Rarely even do the agents know who they have stopped, but rather they are making the stop on basis of race and ethnicity and then proceeding from there. Last month, law enforcement officers around the metro held a press conference saying they have received complaints of federal agents racially profiling, and these profiling incidents have included federal agents racially profiling off-duty Minnesota law enforcement officers. One officer from Brooklyn Park was assaulted when she attempted to record the encounter with federal agents. The Fifth Amendment requires due process before the government deprives someone of life, liberty, or property. The Due Process Clause protects individuals from government action where it is motivated by animus based on race, ethnicity, national origin, or religion. The right to equal protection, explicitly set forth as applying to the states in the 14th Amendment, is applied to the federal government through the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. These constitutional protections are designed to protect against the exact sort of stops outlined in Hussein v. Noem. Not just ACLU Minnesota cases either. In a rather remarkable order in January, Judge Schultz, Chief Judge of the U.S. District Court of Minnesota, said that ICE violated 96 court orders across 74 cases just this month and just that month and just here in Minnesota. The Sixth Amendment protects the right to counsel. The federal government has been routinely denying immigration attorneys the right to meet with their clients, with one attorney told by federal agents that they, quote, don't do attorney visitation. They didn't tell them that immediately, of course. They made him wait for 4 hours. These attorneys noted that for the last decade, when immigrant clients have been held at Whipple Federal Building, they have been allowed attorney visitation. Attorneys say they've received a variety of explanations, including claims that they did not have appointments, that their clients did not ask for them by name, and the Whipple Building cannot accommodate attorney-client visits. Another ICE attorney reportedly told one that, quote, if we let you see your clients, we would have to let all the attorneys see their clients, and imagine the chaos. Finally, on the 10th Amendment, the state of Minnesota and the cities of Minnesota and St. Paul have sued the federal government in Minnesota v. Noem, alleging violations of state and local sovereignty as protected by that amendment. These actions have caused untold damage to our residents through direct physical assault, liberal deployment of chemical irritants like tear gas and pepper spray, and countless arrests and restraints. It has caused untold trauma through unlawful arrests and detentions, family separation, and families forced into hiding, regardless of citizenship status and solely based on their race and ethnicity. I want to stress the words, the adjectives that I used in those previous statements. Untold, countless. One of the hardest aspects of our work now is to accurately quantify the breadth of the harm. We do not know how many Minnesota residents have been deported, detained, arrested, injured, or violated. We do not know how many Minnesotans are currently in detention, where they are being held, and whether they have a legal status that would prohibit their ongoing detention. This is a direct result of the disinformation and complete lack of transparency by the federal government. According to DHS earlier this month, they say they have arrested 4,000 immigrants with criminal records here in this operation. We have no reason to believe that number is accurate, as no comprehensive list of names, records, immigration status, or present detention status has been provided. By way of example for this discrepancy, DHS claims there are 1,360 individuals with ICE detainers in Minnesota custody. However, a survey of the Department of Corrections records, there are only 207 individuals in state custody and another 97 in county custody, resulting in a difference of nearly 1,000 individuals. These falsehoods are not confined to press releases and press conferences. In the Minnesota District Court, where the DOJ or courts have dismissed cases where the defendants were accused of violently assaulting federal officers. That includes cases in Minneapolis, where agents fired at someone through the door who they accused of violently beating an ICE officer with weapons. That case was dismissed by the DOJ with prejudice, meaning they cannot bring those charges again, and the two officers were placed on leave after making untruthful statements. Includes another case in Minneapolis where courts dismissed the charges against a man accused of tackling officers after reviewing the video and seeing no tackle, and DOJ presented vague and contradictory versions of the events. A Virginia man whose case was dismissed by the court where he was accused of ramming his car into agents after the DOJ presented no evidence and no witnesses to support the charges. Around the country, we're seeing similar things. In Chicago, the DOJ arrested 92 people, charged 13, and secured zero convictions. In Los Angeles, the DOJ is 0-6 on cases that have gone to trial stemming from the Los Angeles surge, despite having a better than 99% success rate on all cases in 2024. Juries have also issued not guilty verdicts for people accused of assaulting ICE or similar charges in Louisville, Seattle, Washington, D.C. This overcharging, poor case management, and hyper-aggressive tactics have led to unprecedented pushback from the federal judiciary. Our chief judge here in the District of Minnesota noted that ICE has likely violated more court orders in January 2026 than some federal agencies have violated in their entire existence. As Judge Nancy Brazel, also a district court judge in the District of Minnesota, noted, the Constitution does not permit the government to arrest thousands of individuals and then disregard their constitutional rights because it would be too challenging. One judge in West Virginia called this entire operation, both here and around the country, an assault on the constitutional order. Similarly, around the country, we have seen DHS and the federal government infringing upon people's rights, attempting to punish elected officials for protected speech, using administrative subpoenas to investigate and intimidate critics, and eliminating important trainings on constitutional rights to get more agents on the streets faster. To say this has devastated the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota would be an understatement. There are roughly 24 attorneys left in the office, and the government has had to bring in military lawyers and DOJ attorneys from other states. Key attorneys in the office are gone, the fraud prosecutions are in disarray, and individuals with lengthy criminal backgrounds facing serious charges are having those cases dismissed in favor of maintaining staffing on the unlawful detentions. One former DOJ attorney described the process. When an experienced DOJ attorney leaves the office needs to assess their caseload and decide which prosecutions to assign to new attorneys and which prosecutions they are simply unable to sustain. In these cases here in Minnesota, in order to maintain staffing on their immigration cases, the DOJ has recently dismissed cases against a man with 12 convictions, including strangling a pregnant woman who is facing charges for trafficking methamphetamine. They dropped a case against a man charged with trafficking 7,600 fentanyl pills and 12 pounds of cocaine. They dropped charges against a man charged with conspiracy to distribute the 3 pounds of methamphetamine that he was arrested with. Thank you for your time today. We're available for questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beeler. Welcome to the committee. Do you also have a presentation or?
I do not. Thank you, okay. Chair.
All right. Okay. So I just have a comment and then I will open it up for discussion among the members here. So, first of all, I thank you so much for being here to present today and for your work. It just strikes me that here we are sitting quietly in this conference room, in this committee, and hearing the words about what's happening, and it is, you know, listening and having the images in mind that we've seen over the last months. It's really chilling. It's absolutely chilling. And hearing you all talk about it in these calm, quiet words, there's almost a disconnect there. Because this is the core of our country. This is what we all depend on. This is what we call America, is that we have these rights. And the violation of them is just absolutely stunning. And I do have a question for Ms. Decker. And you talked about people being disappeared. And I wanted to ask you, when someone disappears and their family doesn't know how does the family even know whether it was some kind of deportation action or whether it was some random kidnapper or murderer or something? I mean, that how do they have any idea what happened to the person?
Madam Chair, that is a growing concern, and that has been so. Immigrant Law Center runs a detention hotline where we receive calls from people and family members, community advocates, where somebody who has been detained can call for information about the immigration court process, the detention process. One of the rising concerns that is being expressed in those calls is how do we know that the people who have taken our loved one or our friend or our neighbor are in fact lawful authorities, because we have no way of identifying them and we have no way of locating them. So unfortunately, that is a growing concern. And it can often take, as I mentioned, days, hours or days to confirm where a person has been taken.
Thank you. So if indeed it was another kind of kidnapping, there might not be any follow-up to that, right? Because people wouldn't know what to think.
I think that is, Madam Chair, I think that is a very valid concern. And I think as there is also a growing fear of reaching out by many communities to law enforcement, we have also heard from communities concern about reaching out to law enforcement because of the fear of that reaching out to law enforcement could increase contact with the federal government, which could lead to immigration issues.
Thank you. Thank you. So thank you for that. And so, you know, as I said, this is absolutely chilling stuff. And I have to say, you know, I know, we all know sitting here today, the legislature here is a very political body. We're either Democrats or Republicans in this room. And, you know, that's how we operate. And we have this kind of binary system in our country. But I really think this should really transcend that. This is not about partisanship. It isn't about what team we're on. We all take an oath to abide by the Constitution of the United States and the state of Minnesota. And if we don't, I know that members on this committee are concerned about civil rights. That is our job. It is one of our jobs on this committee, probably our most important job, is to monitor and to guard civil rights of Minnesotans. And it shouldn't matter what the rationale is for ICE or any other federal agent being in our state. It doesn't matter what job they are ostensibly sent here to do. They have to do it within the bounds of the Constitution. There is simply no excuse for violating the fundamental rights that are given to Americans in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. And it is absolutely stunning the degree to which our rights have been violated and are continuing to be violated. And thank you for the work you're doing. I'll turn to other members if there are comments and questions. And we do have some bills to hear as well. All right, not seeing any. So thank you very much for coming in today. We really appreciate it. We appreciate the work you do on behalf of Minnesotans, on behalf of Americans, on behalf of the Bill of Rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, we will turn now to the first bill on our agenda, which is going to be House File 3477. Representative Long, and the motion here is going to be for House File 3477 to be placed on the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling. Members, we should all be able to agree that when a citizen's constitutional rights have been violated, that there should be a remedy. The Constitution is fundamental to the fabric of our society, and each of us takes an oath to uphold it when we are sworn into office. Yet there is a gap in current federal statutes and case law that means many constitutional violations by federal actors fall through the cracks and don't lead to accountability. The bill I'm proposing today, the Universal Constitutional Remedies Act, would patch these constitutional holes by establishing a civil remedy when a constitutional right has been violated by a government actor. This mirrors what has been in place for state and local actors since 1874 under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. These so-called Section 1983 claims have helped provide accountability for local and state actors when they violate the Constitution. But the federal government, in its wisdom, did not include itself in these claims. The concept of expanding these claims to all government actors, including federal, has been around for at least 40 years, and at least six other states have these laws in effect. This bill closely mirrors the language of Section 1983, except it applies to all local, state, and federal actors. This even-handed application is important to show that we are not discriminating against federal actors. While this idea is not new, the recent context of federal government immigration enforcement in Minnesota has made plain the need for this law. There has been bipartisan acknowledgement of the widespread violations of constitutional rights that we have seen in our state under Operation Metro Surge. Several GOP legislators have made that clear publicly as well, with one saying, quote, "Constitutional rights are being violated right now, and I can tell you that, and it's not okay." Courts have found such violations as well. They have found First Amendment violations, including retaliation for protected speech activities. They have found Fourth Amendment violations, including unreasonable searches and seizures. They have found Fifth Amendment due process violations, including depriving detainees of their right to counsel. A judge wrote of detention conditions, quote, "It appears that in planning for Operation Metro Surge, the government failed to plan for the constitutional rights of its civil detainees." But these cases were all for injunctive relief and not for relief for the harm caused to the individual citizens. When a citizen has had property damage, like their door being broken in violation of the Fourth Amendment, or physical harm in retaliation for free speech in violation of the First Amendment, or most tragically of all, loss of life in violation of the Fifth Amendment, there must be a remedy. And the public agrees. When asked, "In your opinion, do you think federal officers and agents should be granted immunity from prosecution for any unlawful activity during immigration enforcement actions?" The answer was overwhelming. 88% of Minnesotans said no. Federal agents should not be granted immunity and should be held accountable. And this bill would be far less than criminal prosecution. It's simply civil liability. In the 1983 context, those claims are not paid by the government employee, but by local or state governments. This does two things. It makes whole the individuals who were harmed, and it provides some accountability by encouraging governments to change their policies, such as better training their employees to follow the Constitution. This bill would apply not to a particular type of action or actor. It is not limited to immigration enforcement or even to federal actors. It would protect against constitutional violations by any future administration, be they Democratic or Republican. Put simply, if we believe in the Constitution, then we need to protect and enforce its rights. That has been available for state and local constitutional violations for 152 years. This bill would be an important step to apply the same protections to Minnesotans for constitutional violations by federal actors. I have two testifiers with me today, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Long. So, is it Harrison Stark is first? Welcome to the committee, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair. Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Harrison Stark. I'm senior counsel at the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. And I'm also the author of an explainer that I believe is contained in the legislative record that provides a legal analysis for these kinds of laws, which are often dubbed converse 1983, in that they are a state-created remedy rather than a federal-created remedy for violation of constitutional rights, or state damages remedies against federal officials. That explainer is quite long, so I won't repeat its content here, but instead just want to emphasize a couple points for the committee. The first is that, as you've heard, this legislation would fill a critical gap in our legal and constitutional landscape. Rights are only as strong as their remedies. And without a remedy, rights are not so much protections or rules, but are really just suggestions. While you can get a court order for rights violations that are ongoing, if a violation has already occurred, the primary way that the American legal system rights wrongs is to provide money damages. The idea is that you compensate the victim by making them whole and provide a financial incentive against the perpetrator for them not to continue to violate anyone's legal obligations or rights. It may surprise folks to learn that today there is simply no reliable path to suing federal officials for constitutional violations for money damages, even though you can do that against state and local officials. In fact, it is likely more difficult today in 2026 than at any other time in American history to hold federal officials accountable if they violate constitutional rights. And that applies across administrations and across constitutional provisions. It applies in the excessive force context, in the free speech context, in the Second Amendment context, in the religious liberty context. And the result is that victims of constitutional violations frequently have no redress after the fact, and federal officials have little financial incentive to respect constitutional boundaries. This legislation would fill that gap. The second point is that these laws, even though they are state-created, are not just consistent with the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause, but really vindicate states' historic role in our constitutional system. They are consistent with the Supremacy Clause because they do not elevate state law over federal law, which is what the Supremacy Clause prohibits. Instead, they provide a path for vindicating federal constitutional rights. These laws also can't interfere with legitimate government operations, which is another Supremacy Clause problem, because they only focus on unconstitutional conduct, which by definition can't further the lawful objectives of the federal government. More than that, though, they really fit into a larger arc of states enforcing constitutional boundaries against the federal government. For centuries, state law was the primary mechanism by which individuals turned to vindicate their constitutional rights. And so, although these types of remedies look a little novel in today's legal landscape, they are in fact restoring a much older and storied tradition of states providing remedies for residents, no matter who violates their constitutional rights. Third, and finally, these laws are likely not preempted by federal legislation. It is true that many regular or traditional common law torts, like trespass or nuisance or things like that, must go through the federal regime of the Federal Tort Claims Act, but Congress left an explicit carve-out for any action that is brought for a violation of the U.S. Constitution, which is exactly what these causes of action would provide. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Megan Forbes, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Megan Forbes, and I'm Senior Legislative Counsel at the Institute for Justice. We are a nonprofit public interest law firm that works to protect civil liberties, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. This bill responds to a serious problem. When a person's constitutional rights are violated by federal officials, there are not meaningful legal remedies available in federal or state courts. Right now, if a federal official goes into your house and causes damage without a warrant, takes away a legal firearm, retaliates against you for exercising your right to free speech or freedom of religion, beats you, or even kills you, there's not much that you can do about it to protect your constitutional rights. You cannot sue them in most state courts, and you cannot sue them in federal court, and that's a serious problem. A right without a remedy is not much of a right at all. This bill restores a basic accountability mechanism that was once available at common law and under federal precedent, but that has since been largely gutted. It's an important fix, and it brings much needed reform. As has already been mentioned, a number of states, at least six, have state causes of action just like this, and some of these laws have been on the books for decades. This bill creates accountability, which builds trust. Trust is a critical part of law enforcement. When people think that government agents can act with impunity, it breaks down that trust and makes us all less safe. It makes law enforcement interactions more confrontational and makes them less effective. Finally, I'd like to note that while this bill opens the courthouse door, These cases would still be challenging because of immunity defenses that are judge-made defenses that would continue to exist in the law. There's bipartisan legislation that also seeks to fix that problem that we think is worthy of consideration, too. To wrap things up, we encourage the committee to support this bill and to stand with the Constitution and the state's right to enforce it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, at this point, I'll see if there are any members of the public who wish to testify, and then we will move to the amendments that have been filed. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? So, okay, welcome to the committee. We'd ask you to state your name for the record, and then you've got 2 minutes for your testimony, and we will let you know when the 2 minutes are up. Welcome. Please be seated.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I have a disability that makes it difficult me to sit.
Okay.
Please don't interrupt my testimony. So my name is Dr. Roger Day.
Sir, we need to have you leave the room.
I don't understand this.
What's okay?
Please don't touch me.
Sir,
I am a
ma'am. We'll just let him testify. Okay, 2 minutes. Go ahead.
My disability is a product of color of law assaults. I am a person under multiple color of law assaults from state and federal actors. And so this is a really important bill for me and for everyone. When someone is assaulted by someone acting under color of law, it doesn't just harm the person being assaulted. It harms the administration of justice and the exercise of the Constitution at large, and actually destroys our country. So in my case, it's mostly federal judges who have created false documents about the proceedings in which I've been involved that form the color of law violations. But there are a number of other, you know, state actors who are violating my rights in other ways under color of law, too numerous to get into here. But the Metro Surge has been the impetus for this law, but that's not the only kind of unconstitutional activity that is carried out by people under color of law. So I want to be really careful with this language, make sure it is all inclusive. But this is a law that's long overdue. Our state citizens each need to have this kind of remedy so that justice can prevail for all of us. So I support this bill both in its concept and in its current form. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Day. Does anyone else in the public wish to testify? Okay.
Yeah. I'd just like to ask for a roll call when we're ready to do this on this bill.
Okay. A roll call having been requested. We are going to take up some amendments, Representative Bliss. So you want a roll call on the bill? Okay. All right. So we do have some amendments. Closing the testimony then, since there no other person is wishing to testify. We do have some amendments in the packet. There's an A1 amendment. Does a member wish to offer the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Duran.
Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A1 amendment.
Amendment's been offered. Go ahead, please.
This would remove subdivision 2, removing the substantial concern around an agreement the federal law enforcement partners would have to enter into, when helping out Minnesota. So.
Okay. Any other, well, Representative Long?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So subdivision two, the intent here was to have another belts and suspenders way for there to be a legal hook for federal actors when they are voluntarily entering into agreements with local governments to make sure that they are saying in those agreements that they are going to abide by the state and federal constitutions. It is not core to the bill, so I guess my question to Representative Duran is if I accept his amendment, is that make it more likely that the bill will move out of committee?
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't necessarily think that it's going to change the opinion of some of the people on there, but so.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's not the way we operate around here, the quid pro quo on the taking or, you know, basing the passage of a bill on, hey, will you take this amendment? If so, then will you pass the bill if I take the amendment? That's not the way we work around here. And so you didn't even need to answer that question, Representative. So I don't like that that means of operation. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Chair Scott, I don't view that as a quid pro quo. I mean, this is a matter of will this bill be acceptable to you without this piece? So that is absolutely, I'm sorry, not a quid pro quo. That's just off the wall. I'm sorry. But, you know, if people don't want to be asked, you know, what would make a bill acceptable to them, you certainly don't have to answer that question. But I don't think it's an illegitimate question to be asked in committee. Does anyone else want to speak to the amendment?
Yes, Steer.
Oh, Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chair Long, are you aware that the subdivision two would end all agreements between the federal government and local agencies, drug task force, joint terrorism task force, all those agencies, they would all come to an end?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's not the requirement of subdivision two. Subdivision two requires that the federal government would have to agree to abide by state and local constitution in order to have those agreements. And my assumption is that the federal government would be willing to abide by the constitution.
Representative Steer. Representative Frazier.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this bill. That would be my question to the Rep. Duran, who's moving the amendment. Is the, if we remove this subdivision, are we saying that we're removing it because we have fear that the federal government, whatever the operation is, whatever the collaboration is, that they are not willing to abide by the federal and state constitution?
Representative Steer?
Yeah, you said federal and state. So
correct.
Federal has federal laws and state have state laws. So this is saying that federal law has to comply with state law, which isn't how it works.
Ma'am.
Representative
Thank you,
Frazier.
Madam Chair. But if we just remove, let me just say clear. But the concern is that the feds will say we are not willing to abide by state law.
Representative Steer.
I think the feds will stay with the federal law and the state will stay with state law. I don't think they're going to abide by state law. They're going to abide by federal law.
Madam Chair, may
Representative Frazier.
So our state constitution is pretty much in line with federal law. So what would be the concern?
Okay. All right, I'm going to go to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was my question as well. We keep saying state law, but it's very clearly written in here that it's the Minnesota Constitution. And I feel very strongly that federal agents acting in our state should be following both the United States and the Minnesota Constitution to make it very clear that it's not talking about individual laws and statute books. This is our Constitution. And they should be following both constitutions. Thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Long, I'm just wondering, I know there are some other states that have adopted similar language. Has the federal government signed such agreements so far that you know of? And even going back, I mean, yeah, if you know the answer.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Scott. I don't believe this language is in any other state law. This was our attempt to try to have another hook for having this be legally enforceable. But as I said, this is not the main thrust of the bill. And so I'm willing, in a gesture of hopeful good faith, to view it as a friendly amendment and accept it, should, and hopefully that would get a little bit more to paying most attention to Subdivision 1, which is the core and meat of the proposal.
Okay. Chair Scott? Any other discussion? Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you spoke to the stakeholders in regards to pushing these mandates to come into these agreements with the law enforcement agencies? Have you spoke to any law enforcement agencies about these, or what it would do, or what are the consequences for this?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I have not had conversations directly with law enforcement agencies. I'd love to. We're only in the second week of session, and this was a early bill hearing scheduled, but would be happy to. But as I said, I'm happy to accept your amendment, Representative Duran.
All right, can we move to a vote then? All in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. There is another amendment in the packet, the A2. Does someone want to offer the A2?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Chair Scott.
The A2 is similar to a bill adopted in the Senate that Senator Champion put forth, very similar, and it just clears up the issue around legislating past the past by having a six-year look back from the date of enactment and makes it only for cases of action, causes of action moving forward after the enactment date. So I would submit that for a vote, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Chair Scott, I would unfortunately oppose your amendment. It was in the Senate viewed as a technical fix, but I think it goes beyond that. It, as you state, would prohibit a look back, and given the testimony we heard earlier and the concerns that we have seen in our community with the stark increase in constitutional violations, I don't think that is appropriate. 6 years is the statute of limitations for torts violations in the state, and so that seems to me an appropriate limitation on these causes of actions.
Other discussion? Oh, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for Ms. Davis on House Counsel. Is that okay? Can I go
please,
ahead? All right,
please.
Thank you. I'm just wondering how common it is. I've been around here going on 18 years. I don't recall a lot of legislation that bills that we pass that have a retroactive effective date, a look back of that of this nature. Can you enlighten me a little bit on whether that's common practice? Ms. Davis, thanks.
Ms. Davis.
Sure. Chair and members, Mary Davis from House Research. Effective dates can be retroactive in some situations. There are prohibitions, there are state and federal constitutional prohibitions in some cases against retroactive effective dates. For example, ex post facto laws that are criminal and things that impair contracts. So those are considered by the courts. Our judiciary doesn't keep track of, you know, what kinds of things are passed or anything, so we don't have like numbers or anything like that. But retroactive effective dates are less common because of the various limits under state and federal constitutional provisions. But they do pass from time to time. There are civil law bills that have the occasional retroactive effective date. And the language that we use is similar to what is in the bill. Or if you're trying to make sure that it's not retroactive, we use the language that's in the amendment.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Long, I hesitate. The reason for the amendment is I hesitate to go down this road of making law that's retroactive in nature. And I understand why you want to do it, but I just have a real lack of comfort in setting some sort of precedent to do that. So I would encourage the adoption of the A2. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other members? Representative Moeller?
Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Scott. I was thinking of a situation where I don't know if it was written to take care of situations that occurred in the past, and that's this sexual assault allegations, the civil liability for sexual assault cases. That was an example of a law where it was written in a way to open up the window of opportunity to go back in time and sue their abusers. So I just wanted to offer that as an example. I know that won't change your mind, but it came to mind. Thank you.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question more for the author, but how did we arrive at 6 years? Why not go back farther and cover 3.1 million detained and deported that were under the Obama administration, including the 67 deaths that occurred in custody? Why not go back even farther?
Representative Long?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. As I stated, 6 years is the statute of limitation for torts, and so we mirrored that.
Thank you, Representative Long. Representative Engen, anything further? And, of course, that does take us back into the Biden administration. So I guess we'll vote on the amendment, but I'll give you the final word on it, Representative Long. But I just want to say that given the presentation that we heard, the unbelievable, unprecedented violation of civil rights in this state over the last few months, to not have this be retroactive is, to me, would be a travesty. I don't know if, you know, it would have to go back 6 years, but, and I assume that we could even shorten that in terms of a look back. I don't know if that's something that's been considered. But to think about the things that have happened to Minnesotans, where, as was stated, if you don't have a remedy, you don't have any rights. And how do we, what do we do for someone whose door was kicked in without a warrant and without any exigent circumstances, completely illegally? How, what do we do for that person? What remedy does that person have? And without this, I think the answer is none. And that's really horrifying to me. So I certainly am not inclined to vote for this amendment. I'm going to vote no, and Representative Long will give you the final word on it.
I think you said it very well, Chair Liebling.
Thank you. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. And we have the A3 amendment. And does someone wish to offer the A3 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hudson.
No. Sorry, Madam Chair, there's a little confusion as to which amendment is which, given the fact that there's two bills that have the same underlying language.
A3 for 3477.
Oh, is this the wrong?
A3 for 3477.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Got that cleared up. So what this amendment would do is it would require state agencies, including the Office of the Attorney General, to absorb any costs related to the litigation that would surely result under Section 1. Pretty simple.
Okay. Thank you. Do you want to offer any explanation of why this is important?
Sure. thanks for that opportunity. So obviously, if we're going to enact a policy that is going to require additional costs in order to cover litigation directed at the state, we don't want that to become a blank check for requests for appropriations in the future that result from litigation being directed at the state that in some cases may be frivolous or without merit. And so rather than have a path to endless requests from agencies to cover costs related to a law that we pass, we're saying that we are going to put a cap on the budget in the form that it's been appropriated by the legislature, and what you get is what you have to work with.
Representative Long?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So if the concern is fiscal costs, then for the state there is no difference for this law than Section 1983, so there shouldn't be any change from the state liability perspective. But I don't believe this is how we've handled large settlements in the past, and so I would oppose the amendment.
Chair Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So two things. Then we need to get a fiscal note before this thing can move forward, just to make sure. Because in addition to what you're adding in this is state and local officials can be held under color of law. So those local units of government may also be sued. So we'd probably need a fiscal note from those people as well. So I support this amendment.
So I guess what I would say is just from my experience, I think if we asked for a fiscal note, I think it would come back saying we can't possibly estimate this. You know, this is just that kind of a thing. I don't know if John Walls is in the room here. Oh, Mr. Walls. Can you speak to this?
Madam Chair, John Walls. Thank you. John Walls, House Fiscal Staff. I was unsure whether there would be costs attributable to this bill. I did request a fiscal note, but due to the just sort of lightness and seeing the schedule, it is not complete. I don't know that I anticipate it would come back with any costs. I'm just unsure, and there's been no response at this juncture.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Walls. So, you know, that being the case, I mean, I would not hold up the bill for that. I mean, if it comes back with a fiscal note, I mean, it is going to the general register, but I assume that if it comes back with a fiscal note, it would have to be re-referred to Ways and Means, clearly. Representative Long?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, as I stated, the overlap for state and local governments is total with Section 1983, and so there shouldn't be any additional costs for state and local governments. And at least in the Senate, the Sheriff's Association said that it was duplicative of the Section 1983 for state and local governments. So I think that is your answer for whether or not there's additional costs.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, your final word then, Representative Long, is, I assume, was you're opposed to the amendment?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So all in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. So we are back on the bill 3477 as amended by the A1, so which removes subdivision two of the bill. So is there any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Try to keep this concise, but there's a lot that needs to be said here. So I found it fascinating to listen to the testifiers claim that there's no path to remedy for constitutional violations at the federal level. Of course, we have the Bevin's decision. We have the Federal Tort Claims Act. What is true, even though it was unstated, is that there are exemptions in there specifically for immigration enforcement. That's longstanding. And so the claim that this is something that other states are doing, yes, other states do have some form of civil action in place, but none of them, as admitted by the author, have this requirement for cooperation between the feds and the states when it comes to adopting or accepting this state-level liability. And there's no compelling the federal government to comply with that requirement in any of these other states. So I just want to be clear about that, is that there are existing federal protections, federal ways for you to seek remedy for violations of your constitutional rights. And we talked about the Supremacy Clause. Again, we have states that cannot impose a liability upon the federal government or federal officers while they're performing their federal duties. And that is because there are certain things that the federal government is tasked with, and one of those is immigration enforcement. And we have, again, we have the Westfall Act that speaks to that. And the impact of this, and I don't think we've talked enough about the part of this bill that requires any federal agency to agree to abide by state law in order to enter into an agreement with local and state law enforcement. That's really the crux of what the problem is here, is we're trying to get around the fact that the Supremacy Clause exists. We're asking the federal government to cede its supremacy to the state of Minnesota for the purpose of bringing litigation against federal officers that, again, is already dealt with at the federal level with the existing framework. And so you would not likely see federal agencies agree to do that, which means that state and local authorities would not just no longer be cooperating with ICE, but they wouldn't be cooperating with the DEA, the FBI, the ATF, DHS, DOJ, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Any joint operations involving law enforcement or enforcement of federal law would basically be stymied by this provision if it were to become law. And my last concern with this bill is that it seems to further the existing asymmetry between law enforcement that's out there trying to protect the public from public safety threats and activist prosecutors who commonly are able to just decide that regardless of whatever the police encountered or whatever crime is evident or suspected, that they're not going to prosecute. What this does is this elevates the level of scrutiny that already exists upon law enforcement while maintaining the broad prosecutorial and judicial discretion that has enabled people to dismiss cases, not prosecute, and ensure that people don't meet with accountability. I have no interest whatsoever in widening that existing asymmetry. We need to go in the other direction.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. I would just note that we removed the section that you just spoke about that you're concerned about, the section about intergovernmental collaboration agreements. That's no longer in the bill. So those concerns, they were heard, they are removed. Representative Scott, oh. Chair Scott.
Could I respond?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just wanted to point out that the Federal Tort Claims Act is limited to the common law tort claims and not to constitutional violations. And I'd ask if my co-presenter could maybe speak to the very strong limitations on Bivens claims if we have a
Well, second. Why don't we go to Chair Scott and then at the end. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Long, another fear that I have with this as it's written is that it's going to get tied up. There are going to be lawsuits. And because I know we're here talking about the Constitution, but I think there will be constitutional cases brought against this law. And one of my concerns is that we've had a past history under the DFL trifecta. We had three laws that were enacted that have now gone to court, and the taxpayers are left footing the bill for the arguments and for going up against the government. So just the PSEO issue alone is estimated to have cost the taxpayers around $3 million. And so this morning I was on my way in, I was listening to the State Gov committee, and one of the things that your members were talking about is that we want to avoid situations where there are going to be constitutional challenges because it's expensive for the taxpayer. And so my concern is that we're allowing this to happen again, because I you're going up against the Supremacy Clause. That's a heavy lift. And I'm just not sure, maybe you can give me some comfort that those constitutional challenges that this bill would prevail. And maybe your testifiers can give me some comfort that is the case as well. But that's one of my concerns. Another concern I have is that the attorney's fee piece, and I apologize for not having an amendment to address that, but what I don't want to see is frivolous lawsuits brought under something like this. Because there's nothing at stake for the plaintiff if they lose. But there's everything at stake for those, for the defendants. So those are some of the concerns that I have with the bill. Let me ask you this too, because I disagree with the fact that that there won't be a fiscal note to this, because you're scooping in state and local authorities in a way that they haven't been scooped in before by adding the Minnesota State Constitution. So let me ask you, and you're making them, you're holding them accountable for the actions that they take on a local level. So let's say that local city council, a council person passes a law, or the council does, that says we're going to be a sanctuary city, and then a private citizen is harmed by a criminal illegal alien. Is that under your law, under this, if this became law, wouldn't that city council be at risk of being sued under this law?
Representative Long?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Chair Scott, to your first question, we work very hard to make sure that this is as constitutionally sound as we can. We removed the language that is in the underlying 1983 around statutory violations so that that would get around potential supremacy clause concerns. It's only focused on constitutional violations. We didn't do what some other states have done and focus on federal actors or focus on immigration enforcement only. This is applying equally to all actors, federal, state, and local, and equally to all claims. So we've worked very hard to make sure that this is as constitutionally robust as we can, and I'm confident that it would survive a court challenge if one came. I don't know that I could speculate on your hypothetical. I'm not seeing the constitutional amendment violation that you're getting at there.
Chair Scott.
Madam Chair, where's this bill headed afterwards?
It's going to the floor.
I'm going to recommend that it be sent to the State Gov committee, because this does involve state and local governments, and they have not had a chance to see this bill, and I think that they should have a conversation about the effects of it on the state and local level.
Representative Long, so is that a motion, Chair Scott?
Yes, that's a motion. If it's appropriate at this moment, it may not be appropriate until later, but I'll let you make that call, Madam Chair. But
well, I think we could dispose of that right now since okay. We're talking about it.
And I'd like a roll call, please.
Okay, Representative Long.
Yeah, I don't oppose that.
You don't oppose it? Okay.
Nope.
All right.
Then I'll withdraw the roll call.
All right. So, okay. So we'll just change. What we'll do is we'll just change the motion at the end then, Chair Scott, if that's okay with you. So the motion at the end when we vote on the bill will just be to send it to, what is it, state and local government? Okay. Okay. Remind me if I forget. I'm sure you will. Okay. So we won't vote on that at this second, but we'll just add that to the motion, unless members wanted to. I don't know. Okay. Any objection to proceeding that way? Let me put it that way. Okay. So we'll just change the motion at the end to send the bill to state and local government. Okay. Who do we have? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this bill forward. I know that a lot of the context around this specific bill language today has been focused on activity over the last several months in Minnesota. Wherever folks stand on those particular circumstances, I think when I'm looking at this, what's really important to me is how have these things occurred in the past, what's different now, and how might your legislation help people in the future under any administration? And the topics that we talk about in the Judiciary Committee, I always want us to bring that lens of under a different governor with different control at the state capitol with a different president. How are the laws that we're passing, are they going to be helpful under different administrations? And I would hope, at least I was hoping coming to this committee today, that there would be sort of this, and maybe there is, and it just hasn't been clearly stated, but I would hope that there is an underlying agreement in the Judiciary Committee that civil and constitutional rights are something that we need to protect regardless of who is in charge. And I think we can all think of different situations where an administration we don't like is in charge that may do things to us that we feel is unconstitutional. And it's our job, regardless of party, to protect those rights. And so that's how I see your bill. I understand that there's a lot of emotion given the very serious events that have happened in our state, but I do want to take this to the context of what it means for the greater good, in that the Constitution historically seemed to be pretty clear in the past, and unfortunately it just isn't anymore. What I'm hearing, I'm really disappointed to hear from folks who at one time or another have been sworn to uphold laws, question whether or not they need to do that. If you're not sure whether you need to enforce and follow state and federal laws, you have no business trying to enforce any of them. When you enforce laws, it's a very specific separation of powers that you don't get to decide what the laws are that you're enforcing. That's why we're here. It's a checks and balances system. So I understand that there are some folks at the table who are saying, from experience, we may be used to working with federal agencies who disregard the Constitution in pursuit of their duties or orders. I just want to make very clear that when we're talking about legitimate law enforcement activity, not just here in Minnesota, but in the United States, unconstitutional law enforcement activity, unconstitutional activity on the part of a government entity is inherently not legitimate. But what your bill does is give people some accountability, a remedy for that. And I know Chair Scott had mentioned, you know, what are the stakes for somebody? Unfortunately, the violation itself is the stake. It's too late. The accountability, though, is the remedy, and it's something that we can offer. And I wish that we didn't have to sit here and write laws that say, yes, even if you're in the federal government, especially if you're part of a government entity, you absolutely need to follow the Constitution in everything you do. I wish we didn't have to write a bill like this, but it has become very clear, especially clear in this committee, that it just might depend on the whims of an administration who's in place at the time to decide if we do in fact need to follow the Constitution. I find that horrifying. I think anyone of any party would find that horrifying if the tables were turned. True accountability is not only willingness to face consequences, but to support and encourage accountability systems for the people we represent. And so because the Constitution is meant to protect people, the people that we are all here to elected to represent, the Constitution is there to protect them. In our role, in my role as a government official, I cannot suppress those rights. That goes against what I was sworn to do here. I feel strongly that we are all elected here to uphold those rights. And accountability means that we're willing to bring solutions to the table as government officials and not take them away from people. So I really appreciate that you're bringing this bill, and I hope that folks can, if they don't get there today, can at least get around to agreeing that no matter who's in charge, we have got to uphold constitutional rights, no questions asked. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes we make laws in regards to a good faith effort in regards to what we want to do, but don't necessarily think about the consequences that come from our actions sometimes. Would this bill have an impact on current qualified immunity for our state peace officers?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Duran. No, the bill does not address qualified immunity. As my co-presenter mentioned, there is a separate bill out there that does.
Representative Duran, anything further?
So this bill would have no issue with the qualified immunity at all, that what you're saying right now.
Representative Long.
Chair Liebling, Representative Rand, this bill does not touch any qualified immunity precedent.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, final word, Representative Long, and if you want to have your presenter, we need to move, we're way behind, but
thank you. I'll be very brief. I just want to bring us back to what this bill does, which is that it allows Minnesotans the ability to enforce their own rights when their constitutional rights have been violated. And so it is about accountability for constitutional violations, which is something that we all in this room should be able to agree is a right that we want enforced, and 88% of Minnesotans agree. I have trying very hard to work on this in a bipartisan way and get to a place where we could move this forward together, because this is not about any one administration. This is not about any one party. It's about enforcing our constitutional rights for all. I've accepted an amendment to the bill in good faith. I'm happy to have the bill move to state government to have further conversations, and I ask that it move forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Long. So a roll call has been requested. So I will renew the motion on behalf of Representative Long that House File 3477, as amended, be re-referred to state and local government. Correct? Got it?
Yep.
Okay. And the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Chair Scott.
No.
Scott, no. Vice Chair Finke.
Aye.
Finke, aye. Vice Chair Hudson.
No.
Hudson, no. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Duran, no. Representative Engen.
No.
Engen, no. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Mahmoud.
Aye.
Mahmoud, aye. Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Rarick. Excused. Representative Steer.
No.
Steer, no.
Yeah, there are seven ayes and six nays, but because we are, and Representative Rarick is excused, so without a majority, the motion does not prevail. Thank you very much, presenters, and Representative Long. We will move now to Representative Feist Bill, House File 103. Is she here? Representative Feist, you know what, I did not realize this, but Representative Gomez is waiting and she's not on the committee. Do you have presenters that need to leave? Could we take her first?
I have, Madam Chair, I have someone from out of town who is on Zoom, so I think it would be hard to.
Okay, go ahead then. I'm sorry, we didn't,
okay.
We didn't think it through, but go ahead, please.
I'll be succinct in my testifiers as well. Thank you so much for hearing my bill today. I've been working on this bill for several years.
And we
years.
Need to move it first.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. I would like to move my bill before.
Go ahead. And so, so Representative Feist is moving that House File 103 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Go ahead, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. I've been working on this bill for several years now. I'm very excited to be presenting it today. And I want to thank Senate authors Erin May Quaid and Senator Eric Lucero for their bipartisan joint statement in support of this legislation. And before I continue, I would also like to just acknowledge that there are ongoing conversations that are happening and that need to have before this bill would be ready to pass into law. I have always appreciated the opportunity to work with the Chiefs of Police Association, the BCA, and the sheriffs to balance our constitutional protections with our public safety priorities. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that up front. I appreciate the conversations that have been had and know that there will be more conversations to have. With that said, I have always felt strongly about protecting our rights from invasive, unconstitutional government intrusion. This bill is particularly important in this moment when we are seeing the impact of ubiquitous, coordinated surveillance on our state. I'm troubled by the use of data collected by one agency for a stated purpose, now being accessed by another agency for an entirely different purpose of sweeping surveillance. While the target of the surveillance may not be me right now, I worry about which outgroup will be next, depending on who holds the levers of power. The ways that public and private entities collect, utilize, and share our personal data have real implications for our freedom of movement. This data sharing and surveillance impedes all our constitutional rights, and we should be very worried. House File 103 would prohibit dragnet reverse warrants in most circumstances. These warrants are used to identify individuals within a certain mile radius of a crime. They are also used during investigations to identify suspects based on what we search for online and even which articles, videos, or photos we read, watch, and view. The collective scope of such warrants directed at technology companies such as Google are often so expansive in time and geography that they gather data on tens of thousands of private law-abiding citizens. Notably, artificial intelligence will make these reverse search tools even more powerful. The internet has been a huge boon for data collection, and AI will derive new meanings from that data. For example, video analytics systems could label a person's movements or activities as abnormal. Police could ask systems to find data patterns that they believe are associated with illegal activity, such as mapping social relationships to determine gang membership or political affiliations. These searches are becoming increasingly common. I have some stats, but in the interest of time, I'll let one of my experts talk about his stats. But we just know that the use of these warrants is just exponentially increasing year over year. They are not proven effective as an investigative tool, although Representative Steer and I have talked about some scenarios where they have. Overall, if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, they are increasing the size of the haystack exponentially. We've also seen that in other circuits, such as the Fifth Circuit, they have been found unconstitutional. So investigations that have been based on these warrants could be overturned in the future. For these reasons, I believe that this is an important step for the state of Minnesota. And with that, I'll turn it over to my experts. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Feist. So we have Chad Marlowe. And we have...
Yes, Chair, I'm here.
All right. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Chad Marlowe, and I'm an ACLU Senior Policy Counsel where I focus on privacy, surveillance, and technology issues. I am here to urge you to act favorably on HF 103, a bill that would ban dragnet reverse warrants, which place innumerable people under criminal suspicion simply because they were in the wrong place or typed the wrong phrase at the wrong time. Due to time, I will limit my testimony to three issues. Issue one, reverse warrants are a troubling 21st century version of a general warrant. America's opposition to general warrants dates back to pre-revolutionary war times, when the British king used writs of assistance to conduct unrestricted searches within areas of questionable loyalty to him. But since its adoption 234 years ago, the Fourth Amendment has prohibited government searches without a warrant based on probable cause and particularity as to the suspect, a standard reverse warrants do not meet. The threat these technologically supercharged general warrants present is real and growing. For example, the number of reverse location warrants Google alone received from Minnesota jumped from 22 in 2018 to 207 in 2019, a staggering single-year increase of 841%. Issue two, while reverse warrants threaten everyone's privacy, they produce increased risks for certain populations. In most cases, reverse warrant identification marks only the first of many privacy violations to follow. This is because once identified, investigators will need to relentlessly pry into that person's life until they can rule them in or out as a criminal suspect. But falling under the umbrella of criminal suspicion means very different things for different populations. For persons of color, immigrants, protesters, LGBTQ+ persons, or persons seeking abortion care, for example, this unfounded suspicion not only threatens their privacy, it can threaten their freedom and even their lives. In issue three, reverse warrants are an ineffective surveillance tool. When it comes to identifying criminals, reverse warrants are good at increasing the size of the haystack, but very poor at finding the needle. Imagine a reverse keyword warrant sent to Google identifies 100 suspects who entered a keyword of interest into Google's search engine. But what if the criminal used DuckDuckGo? Or did their search using Safari on an iPhone? Or didn't do research related to their crime at all? That leaves law enforcement chasing down 100 dead-end leads while missing the actual perpetrator entirely. What this means is that banning reverse warrants would produce an important win for civil rights and civil liberties in Minnesota at virtually no cost to law enforcement. Let me end my testimony there, but of course I'm available for any questions.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Chris Wayland. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Chris Wayland. I am the chair of Restore the Fourth Minnesota. We are a grassroots privacy and anti-mass surveillance advocacy organization. I'd like to echo all of the points that Chad Marlow made and urge all of you to support Representative Vice Bill. I work with technology as part of my day job. I built a bunch of databases that try to correlate between random user IP addresses and account information, and really want to emphasize Chad Marlow's point about that. You're just increasing the size of the haystack in the hopes of making it easier to find the needle. I have built those databases with those needles, and it's hard to correlate random IP addresses with account information, and you don't necessarily put down your confidence score of like, is this location accurately tied to this account? If you're just using an IP address or some other browser header, law enforcement might not necessarily know that you've used a very weak signal to make that correlation if it's not provided in that way. But like fundamentally, these are dragnet surveillance systems. You're trying to search 1,000 houses to look for the smugglers. It's fundamentally antithetical to the reason and purpose of the Fourth Amendment. And you can try to narrow the language of the warrants and make them as tailored and work with the companies as closely as possible to make it as privacy preserving as possible. But the fundamental ethos of these warrants is we don't know who we're trying to target. We don't know who did it. We need to inverse the traditional probable cause nature of like, we have a specific target and we need things from them. But instead you're just like asking, can we just get as much info from someplace as possible because we don't know where to look? It's perverting the nature of the Fourth Amendment, and we strongly urge you to ban it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none.
She's just tired of this.
The opposite of wanting to testify. Member discussion. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you walk me through the process of getting one of these warrants and what data you receive after you receive, I guess, a warrant for this?
Representative Feist.
So the way it works is it's reverse of a normal warrant. So a normal warrant, you're showing probable cause of a specific criminal suspect. And in this case, in the context of a geolocation warrant, you're just saying who all happened to be in a certain geographic area at a certain time. In the context of a keyword search warrant or even broader, you know, they're looking at what are people's online habits, and they don't have a specific individual in mind who they have gotten a warrant because they suspect that person of an offense. Rather, they just want to know, for example, there was a case in California where there was a hit and run, and they were just like, who all searched for hit and run? And so every single like law-abiding private citizen who was curious what happened in that hit and run got swept up into the surveillance. And I've had a really good conversation with Representative Steer about a specific incident where it was successfully used, and I think you said that like 30 individuals' private data was collected. A lot of the circumstances that we're talking about, it's like tens of thousands of people whose data is collected in these types of reverse warrants. And if that doesn't directly enough answer your question, I'm happy to also have Chad Marlow answer.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what information after you like get one of these warrants, I guess, can you let everybody know what type of information you actually receive first? Like what are you getting from this warrant?
Representative Feist.
Yep. So for example, if law enforcement reaches out to Google and they ask, can you please tell us who all was in a certain X mile radius, then they're getting like IP address information. Google is telling them all of the private citizens who happen to be in a certain location at that certain time window.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a little bit more limited in that. So what we actually receive is more of like a phone number, IMSI or IMEI. I've written these warrants before, and they're very, very long. They're very strict on how these things are done. So we're actually receiving very minimal information right away. We don't even receive all this information until we write a separate warrant to Google or to some of these other agencies. So there's multiple different steps inside this process here, and I'm just trying to figure out, you know, we're hearing all this information that is supposed to be received by all these, you know, by the law enforcement officers, but the realistic, I guess the outcome of this is actually we're limited on a lot of the a lot of the information we receive, and we actually have to expand that by a separate warrant that's approved by a judiciary, you know, part of the law. So I'm just trying to figure out here, because usually when I've got these back, there's been no identifying, there's no addresses, no nothing, unless I go an extra step and try to figure out this, right? So it's a step process in trying to get this stuff through. So no matter what, we're taking the legal steps to make sure that these are, you know, done properly, that we're not just invading everybody's privacy by receiving all this information just at the whim, right? So just one search warrant doesn't give us everybody's information. So we have to, there's a step process in these things, and I think we need to be very clear when we talk about this stuff. And so one of the things that we need to make sure is that we're not limiting law enforcement's ability to help out, especially in certain areas, like, you know, where I'm from. There's a lot of space out there. And so if I'm not able to use this in a hit and run crash where someone dies, and I'm not able to figure out who's in that area because your bill limited us to being able to use this as a tool, we have no way of justifying that, I guess. We're no way of helping out that family that just lost somebody. There's no surveillance out there in the woods. There's usually no bystanders on the highway. We get this stuff, and we got to be able to use these tools to be successful in our job. But I think we need to be very clear when we're talking about these things. It's not necessarily that we're receiving all this information about everybody's lives and their addresses and everything else. And that's wrong, because there's steps that we have to go through, and it's all done by the court's approval. So I guess we just need to be careful about what we're talking about with this. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, could I respond?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, I hear you. I'm absolutely willing to work with you to look at certain scenarios where we think that these warrants, the public safety interest, supersedes the Fourth Amendment constitutional right to privacy. And I think that there are scenarios where that is the case. I would say that, you know, when we are, you know, even when it's 30 people and not tens of thousands of people, you get this information, and like you said, you then use other surveillance tools that we have, you know, provided for limited use to then further investigate people who have not been identified specifically as a criminal suspect based on other tools. So I hear you. There is an important role for the courts to play, and I think there is a way to do this that strikes the right balance, and I'm willing to work with you on that.
Thank you. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another concern of mine with this bill is the sudden emergency aspect of things. Yeah. So you got to realize when an emergency happens, how many people are going to be in this area, or how many people are we looking at then? So we're expanding our scope with that aspect as well. So not only are we not targeting, we might actually have a bigger area with this. So then we're gathering everybody's information with this. So, you know, that's a huge concern of mine. So we're not actually going in there with a targeted approach now. Now, in a sudden emergency, we have everybody. You know, we have everybody in this area, and that's all of us inside this building. If something happened with inside this building right here, now we have everybody's information now. So what you're saying is that it's okay for that situation, but it's not okay for an active investigation to help out and, you know, a family or try to find the person that killed somebody in a remote area. I'm trying to figure that out.
Thank you, Representative Duran. Anybody else? Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to call up Executive Director of Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Jeff Potts, so he can talk about some of the successes with the reverse location lookup, if that's okay.
Yeah, you know what, Representative Steer, this bill, if it survives this committee, will go to public safety, and I think that would be, we're just really running out of time, and I know Chair Scott has to leave. We've already canceled the next bill, so if we could hold off on that, we would appreciate it.
Yep, I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe we can get through this. And thank you for working with the chiefs and the sheriffs on this bill. I do think we can get it somewhere, but not in its current form.
Yeah, so I have a question for you, Representative Feist. So is there any restriction right now? Maybe this would even be for Mr. Hopkins, but when this information is gathered, are there restrictions on how the information's used or stored or when it has to be destroyed? I mean, is it classified under the Data Practices Act, Mr. Hopkins?
So, Madam Chair, if this was gathered as part of a law enforcement investigation, it would be classified as confidential as part of that law enforcement investigation under the Data Practices Act. When the investigation was no longer active, the data could become public as part of the investigation file. That's how criminal investigative data under the Data Practices Act typically operates.
Thank you. So this data that's being collected could eventually become public. And is there any requirement in law for it to be destroyed, Mr. Hopkins?
Madam Chair, not in Chapter 13. The records retention is handled under a different section of law. There are records retention schedules that every government agency has. So the destruction of records would be handled by that particular law enforcement agency's records retention schedule.
All right, thank you. So, boy, that's kind of concerning. So there's not only, you know, I hear that there are things about this bill that need to be worked on. It's pretty clear that there needs to be some fine-tuning and some further work. But it's really concerning to me that, you know, if you do this warrant, so you did a search term, and now suddenly, now after a period of time, that's public data. Mm-hmm. Or that you were in a certain place, that becomes public data. There's something right there that I think could be worked on. Any further discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Feist. And I'm going to miss you because you're always so willing to work with others on your bills to get them right. And, you know, it's been said around here a lot that when everybody's a little bit unhappy, it's usually the sign of a good bill, and that seems to kind of be your trend or for you. I can think of a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, on these kind of subjects, you work well with others. And I have concerns, as Chair Liebling stated, that this data is out there forever and ever, or at least until the data retention schedule, that's largely outdated, by the way, that it's just out there in la-la land where anybody could scoop it up. So I think there are some exigent circumstances that we need to add. I think there are some timelines on just some restrictions on sort of this non-hit data. That's, if I could borrow that from the ALPR law, is that after a certain amount of time, the non-hit data has to be deleted. So I think... and then I've often thought, you know, when you get a warrant, maybe this is a question law enforcement can clarify at some point, but when you get one of these warrants, how big of a geographic area is allowed to be searched? Is there a way to, like, and maybe there's no good solution for that, for narrowing that down, but it seems like there ought to be ways to make it happen. Because I'm like you, I largely don't like these mm-hmm. for the reasons you stated, but I do understand, you know, if I have a missing child or grandchild, I would like this, you know, this technology to be used to find them. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Representative Feist, for agreeing to work on this bill.
Yeah. Final word, Representative Feist.
Thank you for the discussion today. The discussion will definitely continue. I appreciate the input and look forward to collaborating with stakeholders to make this bill workable. Thank you.
All right. So Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 103 be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you very much. And so for time reasons, we've had to...
hold over the other bill that we were going to hear today. And, of course, the clone of the bill that Representative Long brought is not going to be taken up. So with that, members, we are adjourned.